Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Today's episode is another foray into the world of Prospera, Honduras' innovative Free Cities project. This time, I'm talking to Jorge Colindres, who is Prospera's technical secretary, which is a role akin to the mayor of a traditional municipality. We spent time going into Jorge's responsibilities at Prospera and his opinions on the idea of ZEDES, Honduras' so-called Zones of Employment and Economic Development, which he considers to be the world's most advanced form of these kind of special zones. We also discuss tourism and the problems of political instability and the idea of ZEDES as a response to this instability, as well as the notion of whether or not governments could ever shut down Prospera. We talk about the most compelling arguments against ZEDES and how they manifest in Honduras, and whether Europe is actually a good place for this kind of free cities model. Jorge finishes with some timeless advice for anyone wishing to replicate their model of governance, and also how he sees the future of Prospera over the long term. I would like to say thank you to Jorge for taking the time out of his busy schedule to speak to me. And in the meantime, just sit back and relax and enjoy my conversation with Jorge Colindres. Okay, let's introduce yourself first. Your name and what you're doing here in Prospera.
My name is Jorge Colindres. I am the technical secretary of Prospera Sede. That is Zone for Employment and Economic Development. It's a new type of administrative subdivision of Honduras. And my role is basically to apply the laws, to apply the laws of the Sede. My position is akin to that of a mayor in a municipality. And that's what we're doing, right? We're offering governance services that we think are more attractive to investors, to entrepreneurs, and even to residents. And that's what we're doing, attracting investment with the idea to create jobs and try to take the country to a different direction, a better direction.
So if you're akin to a mayor, describe the difference between a mayor in the old sense and a technical secretary, which is what you are then. What's the difference in the role?
Well, it really depends from an international perspective. That's, you have hundreds of models of governance, right? In here, the city were designed to be governed through a trust. And so the Spanish word for the CEO of a trust is the technical secretary, or secretario técnico. And so because the sede is a political subdivision of the country, it's a jurisdiction alongside municipalities and departments, then the CEO of the trust, the technical secretary, is the mayor of this municipality. And the constitution recognizes sedes as a sort of as enjoying municipal autonomy.
So what about, do you have any role like a mayor would in the sort of ceremonial role? Or does that something that happens in a ZEDE?
Yeah, well, the ZEDEs have a big deal of autonomy to determine and establish their governance frameworks. So in the case of Prospera Sede, while the state organic law granted the technical secretary a very vast administrative, executive, and even legislative powers, we thought that we needed to democratize this and make it more, establish a system of checks and balances. So in Prospera, we created a 9-member council of trustees. It is a legislative council, and so most of the decisions and structures are defined at that stage. That's where we deliver and deliberate on legislative acts and policies, and then we move forward to implementing them.
And your interest in autonomous regions, like ZAs, did that start with Prospera, or was it something that you already had contact with?
Well, it started in 2010 when the concept was introduced into the Honduran public opinion or idiosyncrasy, you know. And I thought it was a great idea. I was studying law at the time, and you know, immediately in law school, I could detect that we had very weak institutions, confusing law, not very clear jurisprudence. And so the idea of being able to create a new zone within the country and adopt different policies, different laws, different institutions, institutions that work better for entrepreneurial activities and business, I thought that was a great idea. And by 2013, I co-founded a think tank with the main focus of deploying the SEDA regime. So I work with government officials to try to deploy it, to try to interpret the different policies and lines within the law and what that meant and how it was going to be applied. I also provided information, you know, to investors. I work with also with several of the first investors groups that came into the country to try to develop SEDAs. And I've been involved ever since. I joined Prospera in 2020, and 2022 I became the technical secretary.
And where are you from originally?
I'm from San Pedro Sula in the mainland of Honduras, Cortes.
And prior to working here, had you been to the island before?
Yes, you know, Roatán, it's very beautiful, but very few times, because it's mostly seen as a tourism area. And, you know, frankly, I don't do much tourism. I do business tourism, and I travel for business and work. But so I've only been here a very few times. And I'm actually very glad that what we're doing here is going to help or is already helping diversify the island's economy, because, you know, tourism is very risky, at least in Honduras, because of, you know, the reputation of the country. And during the pandemic, it was a big issue, right? Tourism industry got a big hit, and the island suffered very much. But fortunately, 2020 was the exact year when Prospera started operating. So despite those challenges, we were investing, you know, trying to develop services, export economy, finance, you know, healthcare, education, many other areas, real estate development.
Other than the pandemic, you said you would consider tourism a risky endeavor here. Is that because of the situation in the whole country? Or, I mean, this is my first time here, and obviously I've come straight to Roatán, but Roatán looks beautiful, and everyone we've met is coming here on holiday. So it's obviously a big part of, you know, what Honduras it means to people, foreign people, and people who are visiting. So why do you think it could be considered risky? And pandemic aside, because that was a very unusual.
No, I think it's a great industry. It provides many jobs. You know, Prospera is involved also in the tourism industry. What I think is risky is solely being dependent on that one. And the reasons are, yes, for the pandemic, but also because Honduras, it has regular political instability. So that really, it's a big challenge for the development of the tourism industry. Basically, bad press, you know, and that's really...
How does that affect what's going on here then? Does that worry people for the same reason that you talk about it in terms of tourism? How does it affect people in a ZA? You know, the general instability of, say, the nation as a whole.
Well, CEDES are a policy that was specifically deployed to deal with these issues. That's the reason why it was deployed. And, without the overall context, it wouldn't have been possible to even exist, right? What we're trying to do is that, given the violences that we see in the public institutions, you know, the Congress and back in 2013, various political sectors thought, well, you know, Honduras keeps having this political instability. every time there's a new crisis, and this is really affecting our capacity to maintain jobs, attract more investment, and basically, you know, get more people out of poverty. So what they devised was a scheme in which we create these highly autonomous zones with top level legal stability guarantees and protections, and also with the freedom to adopt international best practices for, you know, for economic growth and investment and business, establishing businesses. And so that's what we're doing. And I think it's working, you know, because since CEDES were created, we've been through like five political crises. And since 2020 specifically, when we started operating, again, there's been various political crises, but the CEDES keeps bringing investments, keeps bringing jobs, and we're sort of protected from this instability, and that's also protection for our residents, for our businesses, for our investors. So
do you think that makes the idea of a ZA less seductive to a country where there isn't instability? Do you think I like the way you framed it. It's like they're a response to the fact that there is instability. So does that mean in a country that's stable, there's less incentive to create ZAs?
Yes, I think there's definitely less incentive. I mean, if you have good policies, if you have a legal and institutional framework that to a degree has created vast amounts of wealth and well-being, even with whatever challenges they might be facing, then sure. I mean, it's going to be harder to go change all of that, right? But in here in Honduras, you know, we had a crisis in 2009. There was another in 2012. There was another in 2017. There was another earlier this year. So, you know, I think there's support, and there is everybody is conscious that we need to make a big change. But then the question is, what's the change, right? Where are we going? And that's what I think set as our key, because we're not forcing a direction on the whole country. What we're allowing is for Hondurans to partner up with international investors and within privately owned land, create a new governance system to which people can adhere voluntarily. And I think that's a great way to push things forward. You know, we don't force it on the whole of the country, but we try out a different scheme in a specific place. And if it works out, then we'll make it grow. And then the rest of the country can copy the policies.
Is that an important aspect of the whole notion of a ZA, the fact that it's an opt-in system? And I mean, I think it's fair to say that around the world, governmental bodies aren't famous for having opt-in policies, let's say.
Yes.
So,
well, you know, yes, and I think that's why CEDES are, I consider it the most advanced legislation in the world in terms of developing these special zones. Because we already saw a very successful zones in Asia, in the Middle East, particularly in China and United Arab Emirates. But these were zones that were sort of pushed by the government and established, and I know they were great. But in here, we went a step further, and so it was not up to the government to designate a zone and say all you people are going to live under this new scheme. It was more of the government opening an opportunity for the private sector to come in and say, hey, government, this is privately owned land. Nobody's living here. It's in a strategic location of the country. Congress determined that the coastal departments were strategic. And basically, these investors, they proposed to a governmentally appointed committee a new system of governance that's going to govern that zone, and it's only going to be applied, voluntarily to people who want to join. The Constitution says that, if you want to develop a CEDES on highly population density zones, then you have to do a referendum in which they agree. But if you do it in low density zones, Prosper has been developing low density zones. That means there were, you know, it's private lands, no inhabitants. And then the state organic law says that you need to do an agreement of coexistence in which establishes the rights and duties, of the residents. And that's what we're done. Like, everybody here has an agreement of coexistence. It says that these are your rights and duties as a resident. And they opt in, they like the system, they see opportunities, and they want to be a part of it.
Do you live here yourself?
Yes. No, I live here, and it's my quality of life has improved greatly, but mostly because of the climate. You know, San Pedro Sula is very, very hot. It's like a humid. It's a valley here. You know, it's basically an island with the breeze, with the sea in front of me. So it's
other than the weather, from a day-to-day perspective, compare and contrast. You know, living in your former city and then living here, say, for example.
Well, there are main differences, like weather and security, but those two, it's just because of the island, right? Roatán is in the island of Roatán. It's generally way more secure than San Pedro Sula. Public services are run differently here. I would say even more efficiently than in San Pedro Sula. General public services, particularly to the city aspect of things, the biggest improvement has been on a business development capacity and the ability to bring investment into the country. I'm an attorney. I have my own firm in San Pedro, and believe me, it is very hard. It's extremely hard. It takes months, to get permits, to get bank accounts, and it's every time you try to bring a new investment into the country, there are differences in procedures. So I was pretty frustrated with that situation. And then here I can invest and bring more people, and they get set up very easily, very clear rules. And
why is it so much harder in, what is it about the system?
Yeah, many reasons. But for starters, in Prospera, we do things digitally, right? And believe me, we use commercial applications like for electronic signatures and document management software. And just by being able to do it electronically and digitally, that really reduces the cost and makes everything easier. In Greater Honduras, you still have to do everything physically. And that means many institutions. Just you're starting a business, you have to deal with like 14, 15 institutions. You have to go like 5 or 10 times to each of those. So, it's even physically extenuating to deal with all of that.
And talking to that, I've asked a lot of people that we've been speaking to in Prospera the question, and they've all, most people have given roughly the same answer. I'd be interested to hear yours. What for you, what is Prospera? Like, if you're explaining it to someone, I kind of know now, but prior to coming here, I had an idea of what it was. And actually, most people that live here give me a different answer to what I thought it was before I came. So what is it for you? How do you explain it to your friends on the mainland or to someone who's never heard of a free city or the platform or whatever?
I think that perhaps the easiest answer is that it's a semi-autonomous city with great rules for investment and entrepreneurs and residents. Most of the contextual problems you would find in Greater Honduras, you won't find them here, but it's still in Honduras, so it's great, and everybody's welcome. I think that would be the shortest.
The next question that everyone always has when we talk about free cities and semi-autonomous regions, et cetera, is, what happens if the government decide to shut you down? Like, so what is that possible? Does that happen? Could it happen?
Yeah, not legally. Legally, it's not possible. Honduras, the state of Honduras granted to the Cerro regime the highest degree of legal stability guarantees that a state, that a nation state can grant. That was done through constitutional amendments, through statutory acts, through judicial rulings, through administrative regulations, through legal stability contracts, through international treaties. So we have the highest degree of legal stability guarantees that any state can give. So no, legally it cannot do. Now, if a state were to act unlawfully, and I think, as a Honduran, we're used to it, and we deal with it, and we fix the situation, and we keep moving forward. We're used to that scenario. So I'm not surprised at all. You know, if a government doesn't abide by its own rules, that's a day-to-day thing. So I think we're pretty well equipped to deal with those challenges.
Is it something that people who live and work here consider? Is it something that they think about?
Yes, of course. You know, there's a very aggressive discourse from political factions against CETES. There's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of lies, and that takes a toll on our commercial relationships and even on the emotional, stability and well-being of workers and residents in the city. But again, you know, I think this is a very great initiative. I think it's the only real opportunity that the country has to considerably start attracting very great levels of investment and reducing poverty. Without CETES, I don't think there's any sensible or even viable strategy even in the works, right? So yeah, those are the challenges, and we deal with them and we keep moving forward.
What is the government's take then when they're against a ZA or an institution that's against a ZA? What's their main argument against it?
Well, the main argument is they say that the previous government took parts of the country and sold them off to foreigners, and that basically foreigners are governing here, which I entirely differ. I'm a Honduran citizen. I'm the mayor. I apply the law. I'm in the legislative council. All our residents, most of our residents, like over 90%, are Honduran. There's also a committee for the adoption of best practices that supervises me and the city itself. And basically, we cannot approve norms without the approval of the camp, which was appointed by the President of the Republic and ratified by Congress. Also, the judicial power also has a role, you know, in the city. Also, the city is not entirely autonomous. Again, we're subject to the Constitution in all matters concerning sovereignty, international relations, issuance of passports and identifications, national defense, immigration. We deal with customs. So, yeah, you know, I think it's empowering Honduras to basically being able finally to change the governance system of Honduras, but in a decentralized way.
Do you know what is the most compelling argument against ZAs? Because when I talk to everyone, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it makes total sense. It seems to be productive for everyone. But what is, you know, where do you actually have to genuinely fight a good argument against ZAs?
Well, it has to do a lot with culture, right? With legal culture and economic philosophy or understandings. So one of the main arguments is that opponents feel there is a loss of sovereignty. And however, the way they interpret sovereignty is, I think it's very telling of the predominant culture and thinking, because they feel that any loss of power or attributions or faculties by the national government is a loss of sovereignty. And of course, to me, that doesn't make any sense, right? I think it's good for freedom. It's good for sovereignty, for democracy, to not have all the powers concentrated in the national government. And so when you create these systems of mass decentralization or of governance features, like into a set of local government, or by allowing the private sector to come into energy sectors or telecom, public services, I think that's great, right? But they feel that threatens sovereignty, and so I think there's an understanding of sovereignty that's really affecting this whole issue, because I think, you know, sovereignty resides in the people, and I think it should be very well distributed through various institutions, including, you know, executive, legislative, judicial, but also in municipalities and also in CETES. And I think that's... However, this only affects a very minimal percentage of the population. This is like the privileged class, actually. So you, when you hear those arguments, it's for me, that's academics, that's journalists, that's businessmen, that's politicians, that's privileged class. Like, most of the people don't care. They just want a job, an investment that they don't go into. And that's most of the people. But of course, this intellectual class, those are the ones in the media. And
are you saying that that particular echelon of society, they consider sovereignty to be nation-state sovereignty? Was that what you were saying? That for them, the notion of sovereignty is nation-state sovereignty, whereas for your average person, myself included, and most of the people I've met here, sovereignty is about self-sovereignty and your ability to express yourself, to create a business, to be an entrepreneur, to whatever. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, correct. Like, for example, and I go into this debate with some prominent businessman in San Pedro Sula, and I tell them, well, you know, this is, I feel very empowered. I'm a Honduran citizen, and I'm participating in creating these new institutions and debating these new norms and policies that we're going to adopt here. And then the counter argument is that, no, we cannot give sovereignty away. They say, how are we losing sovereignty? Well, you're allowing them to make laws. Well, I'm participating in the making. Don't you want to participate in making laws? I think participating in creating a local government, participating in creating new rules, that's an exercise of sovereignty. I feel more sovereign than ever before, you know.
What does your average resident of Hazede then, yourself included, consider? How do you feel about Honduras as a nation? You know, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding there, because most people, I think, on surface level, look at something like Hazede and go, it's a country within a country kind of thing. That was my initial thought when I first mentioned it. So how do you actually feel about Honduras as a country, for example, yourself? Yeah.
Well, that's... So basically, my feeling is that, and I think the most important thing is, basic human rights, you know, life, liberty, property, freedom of speech, and many others, and those are not guaranteed in Greater Honduras. So I would frankly, describe it as a dangerous place, because there's no rule of law and guarantee of human rights, and, you know, it's dangerous. And that's why I'm mostly excited about developing cities, because we have created a framework with new institutions that actually have the capacity to guarantee these rights. And not only because the city is good or because, we're good people, but also because we institutionally created the mechanisms for each of our residents to enforce their rights. We have, first of all, we have a contractual guarantee with each of our residents that they will enjoy as a minimum basis the amount of freedom enjoyed by a U.S. citizen under the U.S. Constitution in accordance with the Supreme Court interpretation up to, I think, June 2018. That's a contractual guarantee. There are some exceptions to that, like obligations like derived from international treaties or in the areas in which we're subject to the national government. But I'm happy to receive that guarantee any time, you know. And then furthermore, we also created a system of dispute resolution in which our residents can get into controversies or get into fights with the city authorities, and they go to independent arbitral tribunals, either locally or in the U.S. That's the International Center for Dispute Resolution in the U.S. That's the American Arbitration Association. And, of course, we also have the Prosper Arbitration Center with great arbiters, former judges. One was a former judge, Supreme Court magistrate of the Arizona Supreme Court. Whereas in Honduras, there's no judicial mechanism to hold the government accountable. Just as an example, if you want to take the government to court, there's only two courts in the whole country that have the jurisdiction to know of that matter. One in San Pedro and one in San Pedro Sula, and the other one in Tegucigalpa. So you have 298 municipalities, and only in two municipalities you can get into fights with government. Then, you know, to get into a fight, I don't want to go too specific on this, but you have to go through an administrative procedure first, and then you used to have to pay a lot of money to be able to sue the government. That was removed this year, actually, a couple of months ago. The Supreme Court eliminated that article, and so now they can sue the government. But then again, you know, it's the same political class appointing the Supreme Court, and then there's it just matters of efficiency and matters of credibility and impartiality, independence, and so, you know, people don't feel protected, and so they just have to lower their heads and do what the bureaucrat says. And
so, on a day-to-day basis, then in Prosperia, what's a thing that needs resolving? Give me an idea of what that might be, or you know. Does it happen a lot? I mean, is it something that you see a lot of?
Well, I think that the biggest asset in the Prosperous system, it's autonomy, even more so than its express legal stability guarantees in paper, because of the fact that we have autonomy on, you know, regulating and authorizing financial activities, healthcare, education, construction, then, you know, we just do it. We just exercise it, and that's why we're developing the Duma Tower, where you know, Sean Paul is setting up a bank in Prospera. We're trying to develop a financial center. And in terms of needs, I would say real estate, more real estate infrastructure, because the island has a deficit of homes. I think also because of, you know, regulations and issuances, problems in the issuance of municipal construction permits, and also in the acquisition of land. There's many issues there, so we make that easier, and we would like to speed up that real estate development to create more homes, more places. Because we're bringing people to work here, and you know, they need a place to live and work. And then the main challenge, I would say, is more financial infrastructure. There's been some challenges dealing with the national financial system, because the CEDA framework is new, it has different norms, and then you know, the discourse from certain political factions also makes the banks a little risk averse. So yeah, I would say those two: more real estate development and more financial infrastructure.
And for you personally, when you look around the whole area of the ZA, Prospera, what's the thing that most excites you? That could be something that's being built, could be just the general freedom that you feel, and again, you know.
You know, particularly, I think those two.
Right. Okay. What's your favorite development then, for example?
Well,
or potential development.
Well, first, you know, the first challenge or mission was to increase the scope, right, of the city. So when I joined the city, it was 58 acres, and then we started working into increasing that footprint, and now we're a little bit over 1,000 acres, and I'm very excited about that. So we spent many months, a lot of resources and efforts into making that happen, and we made it happen. I'm very happy about that, and it's around 600 acres here in Roatan and 400 in La Ceiba, and so we've secured that. Now the next stage would be the developments, and for developments, there are many, really. Of course, Duna is a four-tower project. We also want to do another project that's more affordable. We want to do another a residential tower here in the Pristine Bay Resort, which was incorporated to Prospera. And so those, I think, are very exciting. I want to work to bring co-creators, co-investors, co-developers to help us develop this real estate, because I think we have a very competitive system in terms of taxation and issuances of permits and the types of designs and structures that you can build here. And then the other one is just the financial center. I think that is very incredible. You know, we have a bank that's almost ready to start operations. The Prospera Council just approved a new resolution to allow for various fintech, for the licensing of various fintech activities. And I think that that's really going to make a change, because financial services in Honduras are very limited, and the service is not that great. So I want to convert Prospera into a place where everyone, but mostly Hondurans, can find alternative sources of credit and financing to develop their projects. Also, you know, for guarantees in terms of foreclosing on mortgages and resolving disputes, it's also way easier to do it in Prospera. So if you create all these guarantees for the creditor, then, you know, it's easy to give out funds at lower interest rates. So that's pretty exciting for me.
And the vision for the distant future of Prospera, do you have a, I mean, when you close your eyes and think about it, do you know what it's going to look like? I mean,
you know, the key is going to be to solve the situation with the government so that we're able to deploy more SETES across the country, because I'm confident that Prospera will thrive, but how that would look is like you're going to have a very awesome place, you know, with big infrastructure, with great opportunities and everything in a very circumscribed area. And although that's great and good for the country, good for us, good for everybody, the real vision is to deploy these types of zones all over the country, as was originally envisioned when the constitutional amendment was made, and as has happened, you know, in United Arab Emirates and in China. So I think if we really want to, so that's one, being able to deploy these cities. Then the other one is showcasing to national stakeholders, national decision makers, that these policies work, and so we can start adapting them at the national level. I think that I would really recommend, and I would love for national authorities and experts to actually come study our system, because we've brought experiences from all over the world, from the U.S., from Dubai, and I think there's a lot that the Honduran people in general can learn from what we're doing here.
What would your advice be then to someone who was thinking of duplicating the ZA model in their own country?
Well, it really depends on the problems that you're facing in your country, right? But one of the main problems, I think, at least across Latin America, is bureaucracy and permitting. So I would say if you have to sacrifice some other areas in terms of autonomy or things like that, make sure you get that regulatory autonomy for authorizing, you know, the ability to authorize investment and to tell a businessman and investor, go, you have green light, create, develop, invest. You know, that's the main thing. I think everything else can be sort of a little bit more flexible. Focus on that one, yeah, particularly in Latin America.
What about, you know, Europe? We have a very specific set of problems, governance problems in Europe, say, mm-hmm. which are, I would say, different to here. My thought is that it probably isn't something that would interest a lot of people in Europe, certainly not governments, you know.
Yes, you know, the thing is with Europe is, I have two comments. One, when I've seen the governance structure in Europe, even in unitary states, European countries, at least I think Germany, Spain, and some others have a great deal of decentralization. Switzerland, they have great deals of decentralization, so that really allows for certain differences in policies and a bit of jurisdictional competition and also for more general governmental efficiency, whereas in Latin America, you have states with perhaps even more population, but everything is so tightly concentrated in a very small amount of people that really causes huge socioeconomic problems. So I think that from the decentralization that several of these European countries have, then that part is a bit controlled. And I think, of course, Europe would benefit from some of these models, and they might start to look at it if we're successful here in Latin America and replicate it here. However, my second comment is that I think, frankly, I'm a little afraid of Europe. Like, I think Europe, we're trying to do something great for our country, but sometimes it feels that their foreign policy they might feel threatened, and they expressly, have these policies with the OECD and the Financial Action Task Force, where they sort of feel threatened when these jurisdictions pop up and start pulling in capital from all over the world. And they play dirty. They sometimes say, like, this is money laundering or this or that, but frankly, it's just about tax-based revenue. So that's part that concerns me. And how we've dealt with it is keeping a high degree of a KYC standards, a high degree of regulatory norms in the financial center. We have great experts, the Rotan Financial Services Authority. We have personnel from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in the U.S., from Department of Homeland Security in the U.S., from the Dubai Financial Center, and from the National Commission on Banks and Insurance of Honduras. So we're trying to create a safe environment. What we're trying to do is to pull in capital, right? And I think that that might raise the alarm somewhere else.
When you mentioned that you consider this model of governance to be the most up to date, the most efficient, I forget how you described it, but the pinnacle of governance models. Yeah. Can you talk about that with relative to the way it's been done? Like the governance models you see around you in the rest of Honduras, where do they originate? Who do they serve? Why is the one that you're suggesting so much better?
Do you mean the governorship model in
the
model of governance? Well, concentration of power is really the main issue. Right now, most of the powers of government in Honduras are concentrated in a 128-member Congress. And then now the executive function, everything is concentrated in terms of and dispersed among national level institutions. So I think that is very, very problematic because you're trying to we have 298 municipalities, 18 departments, but everything has to go through Tegucigalpa, and it's a logistical challenge. Not everybody has access to Tegucigalpa. You need a permit for this or that. You have to go to Tegucigalpa. Like you tell somebody in La Ceiba, hey, go to the capital to get that permit. Like, hey, that's very expensive. But in terms of, so that's one thing. Hey, decentralization, we're able to here in the island give out all these permits for various commercial activities. And I think that would be the main thing, to be able to locally authorize these matters and do it in a digital way and do it in a dynamic way. We can do it faster with a lower tax pressure and with a lower compliance cost. And we also create also security. Security is also an issue, right, that we're fixing here. And I think that the issue at heart is alignment of interests, right? Like the political class, they're frankly thinking about political power, about remaining in power, and they have that party going on in Tegucigalpa, but the rest of the country wants to do different things and get a better education for their kids and get more healthcare and all that. And so because we cannot force our policies on people, then we're sort of forced to attract them, right? And that's what we're doing. Our incentives are to attract residents, to attract investors by delivering what they need. And fortunately, we have the autonomy to do so.
And what about security then? What is the security model here, out of interest?
Yes. Again, the same issue. The same issue is concentration of power. So because you have three institutions. You have the public ministry, that's the prosecution body. You have the Supreme Court, and you have the national police, right? Those are the three main bodies. So, and these are big institutions. They have their budgets. They have a lot of personnel. But let's say you're a criminal mastermind. Just imagine you're a criminal mastermind, and you have and you want impunity. What do you do? You only have to buy like a handful of people. It's so concentrated that if you control like the head of the of the public ministry, which are the prosecutors, if you control him or you control a couple of the Supreme Court magistrates or a couple of just the head of the national police, then you're set and done, and then you can that's that. Whereas if you had a decentralized model, it's not as easy to control everyone. You know, it's not as easy to control everyone. There are good judges, there are good prosecutors, there are good policemen, but if you put them under control of you know, people who don't have the best interest of the country at heart. And so what the CEDES do is that they decentralize that function, sort of like in the U.S., right? I mean, you see there's state courts, there's federal courts, there's state prosecutors, federal prosecutors, there's 50 states. So, you know, it's very hard that you're going to say you might for a little while operate in impunity in a certain area, but, you know, if your operation gets big enough, some of the many various independent institutions is going to get you. And I think that's what we're doing. Our law enforcement capabilities don't depend on you know, this concentrated system.
One final question, which we ask to everyone that we interview, and this is, you know, there's no right or wrong answer. Everyone gives something very different. I want you to imagine you're given a 1 year sabbatical from this, during which everything's paid for, so you don't have to worry about earning a living. What would you devote your year to?
Probably education. Education of good economic policy and rights and constitutional rights and how to enforce them. I would love to do that. Of course, if it's a vacation, I would also do other things. But you know, if I could get a sabbatical, I'd go into academic production and try to teach, you know, people how to what economic policies work and what are constitutional rights. How do we create constitutional systems that can actually protect us and allow us to thrive? I very much enjoy doing that.
You do it for Honduras or for the island, or?
I would like to do it at the Latin American level. I think that Latin America is really a place that needs it, but it's not only based on need, it's also based on need and potential. It's got the great need, but also great potential. So it's a hard work, but also a high reward if we're able to improve the governance systems in this part of the world.
Great. Thanks for talking.
Thanks for inviting me. A pleasure.
No problem. Thank you.